Accession number 18662, Reel 2.
There it's Reel 2.
The situation was that we had been told to be at action stations with guns trained fore and aft, and that if fire was directed at the ships, then the fire was to be returned. But there are no particular precautions taken against mine explosions as we were going through a swept channel recognised by international authority.
Anything else to add about that coffee channel incident?
Do you want me to elaborate on what happened? Which is beyond my personal knowledge, but is well recorded.
No, if you just stick to your own personal knowledge,
yes,
please.
The only thing I have to add is that the our dead were buried in the cemetery at Corfu. The majority, of course, of our casualties were, the fatal casualties were missing, presumed killed, and certainly the death occurred in the, as far as the Volarch was concerned. Their five casualties were all missing, believed, killed. The graves have been cared for most meticulously by the kindness of the gravedigger in the Corfu Cemetery under the eye of the British Consul. Some of us went out on the 40th anniversary and unveiled a memorial to those of our shipmates who are missing and who have no known graves. The others have their graves marked in the customary way by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Our wounded were dealt with in the hospital ship Maine, which arrived by order to join the fleet at Corfu, and a board of inquiry was held in HMS Liverpool, which was the flagship of the Commander-in-Chief. And the subsequent international inquiries, of course, were conducted at the International Court of Justice at The Hague.
What effect on morale did the incident have?
I think it had an extremely depressing effect on the, instead of having a well-established annual event, the Fleet Regatta, reactivated in the post-war period at Gargostoli. Of course, the Corfu Channel incident cast a blight over fleet activities. As far as we were concerned, we were, speaking to myself personally, we were very much upset that we were not able to bring our ship back to Malta, even if she was never employed again. And we were eventually very glad to be shipped to Malta, even having to leave our ship behind. She then became a hulk. It was extremely unfortunate that when we joined a new ship, as far as the officers were concerned, it was particularly wounding because the new ship and the old were berthed practically alongside each other in the dockyard in Malta. Although all the ship's company had left by that time, the officers were the surviving officers from the Saumarez. We lost two of our officers were seriously injured in the explosion, and at least two others had injuries which were effects which had to be dealt with after the incident. The captain, for example, was in hospital for quite a considerable time, and another officer who was not immediately diagnosed, but he had a fractured skull in addition to those who were listed. Sorry, that's rather confused. You can talk to me about that afterwards.
Were you personally unscathed?
Yes, more or less. It was fortunate for me that I was unscathed, as you put it, because, of course, I had only recently had my head repaired, and it was not in a position to take any more So I was fortunate when I landed on my feet and my back rather than on my head.
You were on the bridge when the explosions occurred?
Yes.
What happened to you next after this?
We were put in the destroyer base in Manuel Island in Malta, the old Lazaretto, the leper colony, which had been a destroyer base and submarine base throughout the war. And for me, it was particularly unpleasant, because I was in the room next to the one I'd been in and I'd been sunk during the war. So that I associate that place with the smell of oil fuel, because when I was there in 1941, I was soaked in oil fuel, and when I went there again in 1946, although I'd managed to borrow some clothes, nonetheless one was still smelly of oil fuel from, had the scent in one's nostrils, from odd salvage work one was doing on board.
And then you joined the new ship?
It was then decided to send a new ship out. She was a sister ship of the Somers, in the sense that she was HMS Troubridge, a flotilla leader of the next immediate class of destroyer, very similar in practically every respect. And she was brought out with a steaming crew of officers and practically a full ship's company. And she then took over the task of Somers as the leader of the third destroyer flotilla, with the same Captain Selby in command. And we then went into Malta Dockyard and had a refit, and the ship's company was brought up to full strength, and we did a work up. And we were then returned to the Palestine Patrol for a spell. I have nothing to recall on that particular side. And we then went to Venice and Trieste. Then back to Malta.
What was the situation? Did the situation in Trieste affect you at all?
We, during our time in the Mediterranean Fleet, we had to provide a guardship at Pola and in Trieste, as I recall, and ships of our flotilla had provided that duty. If we were there, we were in Trieste for a spell, and that was in fact a rest as far as we were concerned. And in fact, I was given 2 or 3 days off. And my captain said, "You go away and stay away from the ship for 2 or 3 days, have a rest." And said, "I'm sure you've got lots of soldier friends who can look after you." And the funny thing was that when I went to the headquarters shore, the first person I called on was a chap I'd served with during the war, and a colonel in the Coast Guard Guards, and we had been in the invasion of Madagascar together. So that was a nice, convenient liaison to re-establish, and through that I got accommodation for my 2 or 3 days off.
We're now talking about 47, are we?
Yes.
Were you with Troubridge very long?
I was there until July. So that's December to July.
And then?
Do you want any asides to this?
Yes, please.
I mean,
yes.
Colour?
Yes.
For example, while we were in Malta, although the Commander-in-Chief was a very human person, he was looked upon as a very stern, hard man, which is actually not a true description. But neither he nor anybody else thought it was important that the officers of the ceremonies should have some consideration after a rather unpleasant experience, bearing in mind that this was not wartime when we were attuned to explosions and sinkings and the like. And there's no doubt in my mind that the psychological effect on officers and ratings who had had wartime experiences was more serious than their wartime experiences in some respect, because it was so totally unexpected. You asked earlier on, was some expectation of minds being laid? Well, there was no expectation of any of such a violent outcome. So we might have been fired on, there was no doubt that apart from physical effects on somebody like the captain, who was standing conning the ship and therefore took the shock physically, the psychological effect of this unpleasant experience was more damaging. And anyway, to lighten us, a friend offered us passage to the port of Rome, to Civitavecchia. He was going there to on a visit, and also to take the relic of St. Anthony of Padua from Malta back to Italy. And we had an absolutely appalling passage, which didn't worry us unduly, but worried the bishop and clergy who were escorting the sacred relic. And as a consequence of our doctor's ministrations to these priests, he managed to get us admission to a papal audience. And in fact, we had a private audience, just the eight of us, of whom the doctor was the only Catholic. And one of our number was, in fact, from a strict Protestant group, and I think he finally decided not to join the audience. But it was a most moving experience to be received by His Holiness, and Protestants or no, to be given his blessing and to receive a sacred token. She said we could give to a Catholic friend, which I did.
So when you say the eight of you, there were... I don't mean by name. I mean they were all from the...
Somaris.
Somaris.
Yes, yes. Somaris.
Somaris.
Incidentally, the spelling of that I've tried to query with the way it is spelled, as far as we're concerned, is S-A-U-M-A-R-E-Z. But there is a family that has an I somewhere in it, and another one has an O-U instead of an A-U, but I'm assured by some members of the family that there are various spellings. It isn't that it's wrong, it's just that it's different. The reason I'm asking about this is because this is the time when I met my wife, whom I hope you're going to see shortly. I suggested we went on rather than she came and joined us. And because when we were working up off Malta in May 1946, the Fleet Requirements Unit was commanded by a Lieutenant Commander Britton, who had been at school with me, and while we were on the Palestine patrol, we heard that he had been killed as a result of a flying accident. And we also had heard that he'd been married shortly before this unfortunate accident, and as I had been at school with him, I was naturally interested in what happened to her. And I was introduced to the widow by Lieutenant Mark Tennyson, who was the flag lieutenant to the Commander Chief, who was obviously a descendant of Alfred Lord Tennyson. He is now the present Lord Tennyson. And it so happens that one element of my family are the Eltons, and Lord Tennyson, the poet, did not achieve fame until after he'd written In Memoriam, which was about a chap called Hallam, who was an Elson. So we were introduced to each other by this descendant of Lord Tennyson, and provides a nice romantic background, and we subsequently became engaged and got married in 1947. That's an aside which you can eliminate to keep that on the tab list. I thought you'd be amused at that anyway.
So, coming back to the summer of 1947, I think you were saying you left Troubridge.
Yes.
To do what?
To go home, and I got married, and I then went briefly to Leon Solent. They sent six or more lieutenants, Royal Naval lieutenants, to the Fleet Air Arm Base at HMS Daedalus, Leon Solent, where they had a very large number of officers and men, and they needed some regular naval administrative support. Discipline was a little lax. And in fact, during that period, I was working mostly in the commander's office, helping the commander.
Why should discipline have been lax?
Well, I think with the end of the war, there was a general relaxation of tension, and things got a little bit slack. Not at the Daedalus particularly, but all over the place.
Any specific memories from your period at Lee?
No.
So how long?
It was a very happy period because I'd newly married and we were sure and the place was congenial and we managed to get a nice house to rent in Gosport, and it was quite a restful experience after the war. My wife had been a radar wren in first of all on the east coast of England and then out in Ceylon directing fighters.
So you were at Lee from 47 to 48?
No. When I first came home in 47, they asked me what I'd like to do next, and I gave which was very agreeable, and I said that I would like to go to the Naval Staff College in due course, and subsequently to the Army Staff College at Camberley, because that would then fit into the pattern of my wartime experience. And they said, well, you're too young to go to the Naval Staff College, but we'll make a note of it in due course. Well, while I was at Leon Solent, I suddenly got a telephone call to say there was a vacancy at the Army Staff College, and would I like to take it if I would be released? And so I jumped at the opportunity, and the captain and the commodore agreed to my release. So I went to Camberley, and we found ourselves a flat to rent. And I started the course in January 1948. But the point I would like to make is that the commander at Lee was also new. Soon after I got there, there was a change of commander. And the person who took on was Commander Curry, who had been my boss in 1943-44. And it's not irrelevant to what I'm going to tell you in a minute. At the end of this course, which I greatly enjoyed, and of course was helped very much by the fact I'd had so much experience during the war with the army, we had a week which brought the three staff colleges, from the Royal Naval Staff College at Greenwich and the RAF Staff College at Bracknell, joined with the students of the Army Staff College in a joint study period. And at the end of that, there was a general question period in the main lecture theatre. And the team from the amphibious warfare school sat on the platform ready to answer the questions, which they did, except in two cases when I, as they couldn't answer it, I answered the questions. And this, of course, caused a good deal of merriment amongst my fellow students, and ribald jokes and so on. And afterwards, I was introduced to the commodore of the amphibious warfare school, whose name was Dermot Slater. And he said, "You ought to join my organization." And I said, "Well, I would have done, but I was told I would need more experience." And so this was a laugh. Meantime, I'd been appointed to the cadet training cruiser HMS Devonshire. And I'm now going to jump forward in time, if you'll permit me, because a friend of mine during this week at Camberley said that I was spoiling my naval career by specialising in this amphibious warfare, combined operations sphere. I said that I was sure that there would be a time when people of my experience would be required again. And time passed. And in 1956, my dream broke, in the sense that I was called to the Admiral's cabin and in Plymouth, and I'd only just joined his staff 3 days before, and he said I was to go to London and to report to the Vice Chief of Naval Staff. And the person who was responsible for sending for me was Admiral Durnford Slater, and the person who had arranged for me to be made available was Captain Curry, who'd known me during the war and met me at Leon Solent. And you see how things all move together. And the reason for my being sent was that this was July 1956, and it was for the Suez operation, which I then spent the next four or five months involved in the planning and execution of that operation. And that is the... that's amongst the striking episodes in my post-war career, but I've jumped a whole period ahead.
Well, shall we bridge the period by your time?
Very briefly, 2 years in HMS Devonshire, the cadet training ship, 2 years in Singapore as staff officer intelligence for the Singapore area, which was from Burma to Indochina, through the Indonesian islands, out to Bali. Not just Singapore itself, but that wide area. And of course, at that time, we had French activity in Indochina. The Dutch were being ousted from Indonesia, and we had the Malayan emergency in progress in Malaya. And generally speaking, the atmosphere was one of growing independence. Burma, which I believe left the Commonwealth under a misapprehension when they became a republic. Malaya, Indonesia freeing itself from the Dutch. And from a personal point of view, one of the remarkable events was the first riots in Singapore since 1875, were the Bertha Hertog riots.
Maria Hertog?
Yes, I thought her name was Bertha.
Doesn't matter anyway.
Maria Hertog, yes, anyway. Right. Perhaps you're both. That was a very serious matter because it involved the Malay population and particularly, unfortunately, the Malay police in Singapore, which was a very great upset to what had been a perfectly happy relationship, because the police force in Singapore was very largely Malay, with the Chinese element being more in the plainclothes detective branches. The Sikhs were represented, but not strongly, and the riot squad were Gurkhas. Anyway, the riots were put down by Gurkhas sent down from the Federation, and we returned then more or less to normal after about 3 weeks. But meantime, we had a period of curfew in Singapore, and I was, in addition to my duties, it was a rather contrasting a contrast between the two dots of duties. I was made an extra ADC to the governor, so we had to be in attendance on him from time to time, including public occasions, which during the period of tension was an additional anxiety, but particularly because the governor of Borneo was assassinated, and the governor of the High Commissioner in the Federation was also assassinated during this period. The mortality rate amongst senior proconsuls was rather high.
Did you see anything of the riots?
Yes, I mean the fires and that sort of thing, yes. But my wife was it was her first day in town. She'd only just arrived from England, and she'd arrived by ship. I'd been there 2 or 3 months having gone by air, and she and her friend, who'd taken her shopping, were ordered back to home, and she was then under curfew for a couple of weeks because she hadn't at that time got a job, which she subsequently had. Right?
Were the riots frightening to witness?
Yes, in the sense that they were burning people in their cars and that sort of thing. I can't say I saw that. It was not my responsibility to go and get involved. I'd just been a perfect nuisance. The most important thing was to make sure that senior officers' wives went home and stayed at home, and that those people who had business to execute were sent in convoy or by safe routes.
But your general duties in Singapore in this period were intelligence duties, you said?
Yes, including security.
Can you be more specific on what it involved?
As far as intelligence is concerned, that was obviously trying to help to bring together the pattern of events in these various countries in the area for which I was responsible. We worked in close liaison with the Air Force and the Army, obviously, we had the Central Intelligence Committee for the Far East, the Joint Intelligence Committee Far East, operated in the same compound as me. The Commissioner General had his office at the top of the compound. It was called Mappin Terraces because literally that's how the buildings had been built on different levels. Commissioner General at the top, a number of intelligence organizations below, and at the bottom, the Commander-in-Chief of the Far East Fleet. And the Joint Intelligence Bureau.